Hey everyone, before we get going with the episode, I want to make an apology up front. During the episode, there will be some audio issues. So if you notice any kind of change in audio quality during this episode, I like to apologize for that up front. Just letting you guys know. So with that known, enjoy today's episode. I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog stands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
We are a few days away, about a week away from St. Patrick's Day, but we are celebrating it early with the Disney classic Darby O'Gill and the Little People. This is a movie that's been on our list for a while, simply because, you know, it's one of the few movies in the Disney catalog that could technically count as a St. Patrick's Day movie because Irish.
Yeah, I think there might be a DCOM or two, but this is kind of one of the classics.
I'm going to be honest. I don't think I've ever seen this whole movie before this watch through, so it's kind of a new thing for me. I don't know about you.
I had definitely not seen this movie, and I can tell you how I know that, because I thought Sean Connery played Darby O'Gill. If you've never seen this movie, Sean Connery does not play Darby O'Gill.
So, yeah, this movie is based off the Darby O'Gill stories by H.T. Kavanagh, which, again, I did not know that was a thing before watching these movies. But it's not outside of Disney, especially in this era, to take a series of stories and try to make it into one movie. We've talked about a few of them in the already. An example would be The Black Cauldron, you know?
Yeah.
So taking...
Well, I mean, these were folk tales, you know, kind of. I mean, they're in the style of Irish folk tales.
A lot of Irish mythology, superstitions and fairy creatures are in this movie.
So yeah, I am wondering what good old Hermione here that wrote these stories got up to with the fairies. Because
drinking that Irish moonshine.
Well, no, I'm talking about, like, in reality, because Disney calls this Darby O'Gill and the Little People. When she did her version, she called them Darby O'Gill and the Good People. So she's definitely trying to butter up the fairies.
I think it's more of a, we need to, in our title, address that these are leprechauns. So we're just going to call them little people instead of good people, because people, I guess Disney would assume that the general audience wouldn't understand. Well, you said this was about Darby O'Gill and the good people, and all I see are leprechauns.
Well, yeah, I mean, various fey folk in Irish and Celtic mythologies have so many different names. And yeah, I mean, she's not wrong that the good folk and the good people are, you know, one of those names. But it's kind of the same way that you euphemistically refer to people you don't always want to be around. It's like, oh, look at those nice people over there. Let's not go talk to them, you know? Because...
Like like calling a guy who frowns all the time happy.
Yeah. Because a lot of Irish and, you know, British Isles and Irish Isles, you know, kind of mythologies, fairies are not a thing you want to get mixed up with, because they're not nice. These are not your Tinkerbell and her pals kind of fairies.
And we kind of see that in the movie.
Yeah, in a very Disney-fied way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I like that when you go over to her thing, she's like, oh yeah, Darby O'Gill and the good people. It's like, you were trying not to get taken away in the middle of the night, weren't you?
So, yeah, you mentioned Sean Connery, and he's in here.
This was like his like second movie or something in his entire career.
It's weird that we were talking about Kurt Russell's early career last week, and now we're talking about Sean Connery's early career.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't his very first movie, but this was right up there.
Before he was Bond. But, I mean, at least he's playing something closer to his nationality than he would be in, like, Highlander.
You know, it's kind of funny because this is filled with a lot of people who were, you know, Irish, English, and they all are like, okay, let's put on an Irish, you know, even the English are like, let's do an Irish accent and whatever. And then Sean Connery's like, hello, I'm Sean Connery with my big old Scottish accent that I never change in any movie I am ever in my entire life. Which kind of, bless him, he must have been just the worst. I don't know if that was just him being like, nope, not even going to try, or if they tried once, and whoever was his dialect coach was like, this is a man made for looking good and sounding Scottish. Like,
yeah, I'll kind of buy that.
But we've talked before about how there were Disney movies that were kind of... We've talked before about how there were... Walt Disney would go on trips occasionally to other nations and would come back with ideas that would, you know, he would want to advocate for other cultures and other nations. This was one of those movies. The Irish government, as a part of a plan to help spread Irish culture and Irish goodwill, was like, hey, Walt Disney, why don't you come over and we'll teach you about Irish culture and Irish music and, you know, folklore and all kinds of stuff. And maybe you'll make some documentaries about it or some sort of princess movie or whatever you feel like doing. And this was the movie we got out of that trip.
I mean, we weren't going to get Disneyland Dublin out of this.
Well, no. But in fairness, this was before we even had Disney World. You know, so I mean, we were far away from, like, you know,
international parks.
Yeah, international parks and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But,
you
know,
We just had the one back then.
Yeah, I mean, but there were a lot of countries that were like, hey, if our government pays for, like, a grand trip for Disney and some of his animators, we might get, you know, three caballeros or something out of the deal.
promotion for their country, which, you know, makes sense. I mean, and you kind of still see that today with certain countries giving tax write-offs to film studios to film in their countries. Show a little bit of the countryside, show our architecture, our art, our music, and employ locals in your film, and you don't get to pay taxes on the movie.
I mean, I am, you know, I'm currently living in a state that gets a lot of tourism dollars and a lot of, you know, just money in general from people being hired by primarily Disney. But then also we get the kickbacks from tourism, because if you want to come see, you know, where this or that was filmed, or go to some kitschy restaurant or something based on whatever, you know, hey, come to our state and please spend money. So, I mean, it does work. There is value in it. And honestly, this was in the 40s, just after the war. And this was before the great sweep of Irish cultural pride had kind of really taken hold in certain parts of the U.S. And I am in one of the parts of the U.S. that it has a real foothold of Irish cultural heritage. My university that I went to actually has a Irish cultural center that works with the Irish government now and again. We send students over to Ireland to study. The man who runs it just received the highest honor from the Irish president, like within the last couple of months as we're recording this. I took classes from there, you know, as part of my degrees, including some just after hours for funsies classes in the Irish language, stuff about Irish literature and Irish theater and all that is in my background educationally, which is why I might talk about some of this stuff as if I know what I'm talking about, because I do a little bit, because that was part of what our school is known for. When this movie was made, except for pockets of Irish immigrants, you don't really have the kind of general, hey, it's St. Patrick's Day, I'm going to wear my Kiss Me, I'm Irish t-shirt kind of thing you do now.
It's like you said, that's now, but it was not that long ago that the Irish were just as looked down upon as people would look down on Black people or Latinos or Jewish people or Asian people.
Yeah.
So to have it now, to have St. Patrick's Day now is, yeah, kind of a miracle almost.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I prefer the, you know, horror Leprechaun movies more than I did this, but, you know, I mean.
So what exactly is this movie about? So it's never explained in the movie, but Darby O'Gill here, he's an older gentleman. He can see the Fae, and it's apparently the only one that can see the Fae. Any mythological creature of Irish folklore, he can see them. And everyone else kind of considers him a kook because he talks about this like, I met the king of the leprechauns. And they all think, oh, you're just an old coot. You don't know what you're talking about. You've been drinking at the bar too long, et cetera, et cetera.
And the thing is that he is a bit of a, kind of a, I don't want to call him a layabout, but he does kind of tend to shirk off at his job. We know that he is the caretaker for an estate for some lord or other.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see the estate, like, he's let weeds take over in the garden, and it doesn't really look that great, and,
there's you poachers know, getting to the animals.
Yeah, you know, and those poachers might actually be Darby himself. We're not exactly sure. So he's kind of a layabout, and he spends a little too much time in the pub telling tall tales. So at the beginning of the movie, you're not entirely too sure if he really has done the things he claims.
Yeah, right at the beginning in the bar, he tells the tale of how he captured the king of the leprechauns. And when you capture a leprechaun, they offer you 3 wishes. He uses his wishes. And the leprechaun king, Brian Connors, tricks him into making a 4th wish. Which, in the confines of this film, means if you make a 4th wish after making your 3, the wishes you've made are null and void. But I will give him that he made his 4th wish thinking of his friends. Like, okay, you're going to give me 1 more wish. I wish for everything I wish for to be for all my friends.
Yeah, and the thing is he's not really a greedy man. Because he catches the king of the leprechauns, which I kind of want to point out. Did you catch that we got a bit of, I don't know if somebody who works for Doctor Who grew up watching this movie or not, but did you catch that?
I did not. Can you explain?
At the beginning of the movie, when we first are introduced to our Leprechaun King, Darby says that the way to catch the Leprechaun King is once you see him, you cannot look away from him.
Don't blink, blink and you're dead.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing as a weeping angel. You have to keep your eyes fixed and unblinking on him or he'll get away. And that's the thing, is that the king offers him some snuff. And Darby says, oh, so you can blow it in my eyes. I know all your tricks, you know, put the box away and all this kind of stuff. So, and if you watch that scene, Darby is staring directly at him until he agrees to give him the wishes. Because then he's got him trapped, you know. But I like that in the initial thing where he tries to make the wishes, he's not necessarily a greedy man, because King Brian goes like, okay, just wish for a pot of gold. Ha ha, I'm a leprechaun, wish for your pot of gold, wish for a second pot of gold, wish for a third pot of gold, and then let me go on, you know? Because
mm-hmm.
He's like, yeah, I know what humans are like, greedy, gold, leprechaun, I get it. And Darby is immediately like, yeah, but the fae are tricksters, and I know what I'm dealing with here. If I wish for a pot of gold, you'll be like, okay, I'll give you a pot of gold, but also you're going to die in 48 hours or whatever. Because that's what it's like with Irish fairies.
Mm. It's always like, a catch.
You don't mess with these things, you know? They'll give you a wish, and then it immediately comes with a giant curse. And Darby is smart enough to know this. And so the first thing he does is he wishes for his health so that he can be around to take care of his daughter, because as we find out, his wife is dead. He heard a banshee scream the night his wife died. I love how much like weird Irish mythology and culture is worked into this. For such a kitschy little movie, it's really cool. Then his second wish is that he wants his crop to be good.
Potatoes because Irish.
Yeah, but I mean, you can say stereotype, but sometimes stereotypes exist for a reason.
The Great Famine was a thing.
Yeah. And one thing, weirdly, that I did learn from my Irish studies is that what the Irish had learned, due to kind of the English having taken their diversity of other crops that they had been farming, is that the Irish learned that you can get a fully nutritious meal from just potatoes and buttermilk, which is what a lot of people don't realize, is that if you eat potatoes and buttermilk, it actually contains all the nutrients you need to fuel a human body. You'll get all your vitamins, you'll get all, everything you need. And the reason why the potato famine was so bad for Ireland was that when you lose the potato part of that, the Irish then have no food. We're not talking about like, oh, weren't the Irish so silly for depending on one staple crop? It was that the English were taking everything else, and the Irish learned we can subsist, not like happily necessarily, because that's a really boring diet, potatoes and buttermilk. But they were staving off malnutrition. They were healthy as a people.
Survival.
Yeah, it was a really interesting way of survival. And then when the blight hit the potato crop, now they really cannot survive anymore. And that's what made the potato famine so bad. Because if you've got a colonial power taking all of your other food, all of your meat, all of your green leafy vegetables, all of your everything else, you're left with potatoes and buttermilk, which was what the English did not want to eat. If you lose one thing or the other, now you're dead.
Yeah.
So Darby wishes for his health so he can continue to tend his farm and do his work. He
And take care.
wishes for his potato crop to be healthy. Smart man. And then, once he knows that he's going to be healthy and fed, and has worked around the trickery that he thinks he sees coming, then he's like, all right, give me the gold and I'll set it up for my daughter. Which I think is really sweet.
He's thinking of his family. He knows he's not going to be around forever, and he just wants to make sure that his daughter is taken care of. And it's another part of the film that gets talked about is that she's in her 20s, and now everyone in the town is asking her when is she going to get married, because once you hit 30, young lady, no man will want you. Yeah, it's that kind of a movie.
Well, it is the 40s and it is Disney in the 40s, so eh.
Yeah. But like you said, Darby is very lackadaisical to his day job of being the groundskeeper for this lord's estate. So he decides he is going to hire a younger man to do the work because it's a young man's job. And which is where we get Sean Connery as Michael McBride, his replacement. However, I will say this. Yes, he is essentially firing Darby, but he's giving him the equivalent of a severance package. Because he says, hey, I'm going to keep paying you for half of what I've been paying you before every day for not working. I will allow you to stay on my property, albeit in a different house than you've been staying in, because that's the groundskeeper's house. And I will make sure your daughter's taken care of, and you will live a comfortable life for the rest of your days. You don't have to work anymore, sir. You know, you've done your duty. Which, for a lord to go that far for an employee and not just say, you're done, get off my land, you're too old to work, but he's going to take care of this guy because of the, we can presume, years of work he's given his family over the years, taking care of their estate. They're not making him a bad guy, is what I'm saying, which in movies of this type would be the norm.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is he also says, like, hey, when I need the place fixed up and cleaned, you know, when I need to come use it, I'll give your daughter the first refusal of the job, basically. Mm. So, like, he's promising Katie work as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a full-time job because he doesn't need the estate cleaned all the time because he's not using it all the time. But he's like, hey, whenever I'm going to come down and stay, I'm going to need it cleaned and fixed up and like a maid and stuff. And I'll make sure that your daughter is the first one I call if she wants the job. Which is kind of a sweet deal. Mm-hmm.
But Darby doesn't seem to like this idea because this is his job. It's what I'm doing. Now you're going to replace me with a younger guy? Look, if my boss said you're too old to do this job, I'm going to keep you on the payroll and take care of you and your family and you don't have to work anymore, I'll take that deal.
Also, rent-free house?
Yeah.
For the rest of your life?
May not be as big of a house as you've been living in. And he even says, you know, I've lived this in this house since I met my wife. My daughter was born in this house. I can't leave this house. And I understand that. The memories and the sentiment of that house. But it's still the caretaker's house. And he is not legally the caretaker of the estate anymore. But given another house on the land, that's actually a pretty generous deal.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like, people like us are never getting retirement.
Work till we're dead.
Yeah. So the fact that, like, this guy's like, hey, you get a retirement, and it comes with housing, and I'm like, take the deal, Darby. That's a sweet deal.
But then we get our villain, for lack of a better term, of this story. He's not a major villain. He's more of an annoyance. But he's the closest thing to a villain we have in this movie. We have Pony, who is the town bully. He's a right sphincter about everything.
You know, love that all these movies just have a town bully. I love that, like, before the advent of capitalism, apparently every town was just like Ah, here you go. Here is your bully. Like, that was just a job. You got your Gaston in every town.
Yeah.
It's like, this is just this guy's job to be like sort of decently attractive and a complete jerkwad.
So yeah, he doesn't believe any of Darby's tall tales. He belittles him at every moment, and he wants Darby's job as caretaker of the Lord's estate because it'll raise his standing. That is also encouraged by his mother, Sheila. Sheila is also the woman that tells Katie, "Hey, you're still a young woman. You should get married before you're old."
Also, you should marry my son, Pony. And you know, the second that you're like, here, meet my son, his name is Pony, I'm like, you know what, you're not marriageable material because your mom was dumb enough to name you Pony.
Not even Stallion,
Yeah, I
right?
mean, I don't know if that's like a nickname or whatever, but like, and I apologize if that's like, you know,
Typical Irish name.
yeah, like an Irish name that's like, I haven't come across that one before. Like, I don't know if that's like, you know, yes, remember the great tale of the time Cuchulainn fought Pony, you know, like, I don't know, but as someone who mainly only speaks English, it makes me laugh a little bit, and I apologize for that if I shouldn't be, but.
So yeah, Sheila encourages her son Pony to go after the job to ruin Michael doing the job so he'll get fired and Pony can go in and take the job and kick Darby off the land and then marry Katie and raise his standing in the world and yada yada yada. We mwahaha, ha, we're evil.
Yeah, which is weird because it seems like they weren't evil at the beginning of the movie, and then suddenly they are very evil.
When they see an opportunity, they just go full evil. Like, hey, the Lord is here. He needs a new caretaker for the estate. Why don't we ruin everyone else's chances of getting the job? And then you can have the job. Oh, Darby did not tell his daughter that he got fired. Oh, here's a letter from the Lord that explains everything. Why don't we give it to Katie so she can read it so she can get mad at her father and get mad at Michael, and then they can both be gone. So like it doesn't it starts more of you're a single woman, I have a single son, you two should get married to I am going to ruin your family's life to better our standing in the world. That's kind of a gradual turn there. Because Katie doesn't want to marry Pony. All of that side stories to our main story, which is so, as we mentioned, Pony being a bully, the local clergyman has visited the pub and asking for one of the townspeople to, out of the graciousness of their heart, to go to a neighboring town because the neighboring town has just installed a new church bell. And they are donating the previous church bell to the town so their church can finally have a church bell. They just need someone to go to the neighboring town, retrieve the bell, someone with a horse and a cart to bring the bell to their town. The clergyman originally asked Pony because he's a strapping young man, he has a horse, and Pony says, how much are you going to pay me, Padre? To which he says, hey, we're a small town, we're a small church, we don't have a lot to give you. And then Pony just is not interested. You're not paying me, I'm not doing it. I am not a religious man, but do you really want to tempt fate by saying no to a clergyman who asks you to, hey, could you just go to the neighboring town and bring me a thing?
Well, he is the town bully.
True, but still, he even says, hey, if you do this, I can get in a good word to God and save your immortal soul. That should be enough for you.
And Pawnee's like, what soul? I'm a horse.
I don't know. It feels like the clergyman knows something to pon about Pony. Like, hey, I can absolve you of your sin, sir, and I know you've sinned a lot.
I know where that body is buried.
So Darby decides, I'll do it. I'll do it for nothing because, hey, it's the right thing to do. And he says, thank you, Darby. And when you bring the bell here, every time the bell chimes, every Sunday, we will dedicate those chimes to you. They will be your chimes, your music, your bell. Which is a very gracious thing. So Darby is getting his horse ready to go for the next day to go to the neighboring town to retrieve the bell. But turns out the horse is not a horse. I believe
It's a
there were.
puka.
Yes, Pooka, which is a ghost, a demon, a
It's
trickster.
another type of fairy.
Yeah. Who
Pretty much
scares.
everything in this movie is some other kind of fairy.
So it scares Darby. He falls into a well and into the lair of the leprechauns, which is a setup. The king of the leprechauns set the entire thing up so Darby can fall into their lair because they have heard that Darby has been fired from his job and he has done such a good job of keeping the myths alive and telling the town about the fae and all of these superstitions that they should do to appease the fae. So in as their thanks, they are making him one of their tribe. He will live in their tribe and he will enjoy all of the benefits that they have in their tribe. He just can't leave. Because there's always a catch on everything, isn't there?
Yep, that's why you don't mess with the fae.
I mean, I like how he says, "Oh, you'll bleed down here. You'll be happy forever. You won't have to worry about dying or anything like that. But you'll never see your daughter again. You'll never see the above world again. But that's okay because because every night's gonna be a party up in the Leprechaun Land."
I have a feeling, and we need to talk about this because this movie was kind of groundbreaking in the sense of the special effects.
Yeah, because we have full-size actors filmed separately, or at least on different sets, and then interacting with other full-size people who look like full-size people on screen. So the tricks they use to make the little people look little in comparison to the human-sized people.
Yeah, there are no people with dwarfism being used in here. It's just basically early green screen kind of mesh
Yeah,
together.
and a lot of sets because it's very because they're interacting with all of the things around them, so they actually had to build a giant sized throne and a giant sized bagpipes and a giant sized sword and a giant sized jar that the leprechauns are sitting on,
Yeah.
and so, just so these actors can interact with it and give some of the realism to these being leprechaun sized.
Yeah, everybody in this movie is an average sized person. And it's just camera trickery and, overlays and props and sets that do the size changes. We didn't actually talk about it, but I do like at the beginning of the movie that there is a thank you from Walt Disney to the King of the Leprechauns for the use of leprechauns as actors in the movie.
Even Walt fears the Fae.
Yeah. But I gotta say, a lot of this stuff holds up.
You know what I noticed? And we've talked about this with other movies which use similar techniques, like Bedknobs and Broomsticks. The eye line is completely wrong in that movie. In this movie, it hits. Like, they work on with Roger Rabbit to make sure that when a human actor is looking down at a tune, that it's correct, that the eye line matches. In Bedknobs and in Mary Poppins, they did the same thing. Mary Poppins, they did the same thing, so that the actors are looking at the right eye line to the animated characters in the fantasy sequences. In Bedknobs and Broomsticks, they don't. In Darby O'Gill, they do. So when Darby O'Gill is bending down to talk to the King of the Leprechauns, their eyes are locked. Even though these are two separate actors on two separate sets, two separate shots matted on top of each other, they look like they're looking at each other eye to eye.
With the exception of using mats and editing, this is all practical effects. So it really holds up well for a movie made in the 40s. I was shocked at how well the effects held up. A lot of it, you can't even see matte lines. Really tell where the editing blends together.
They're clever enough to make anything surrounding the props black. Like, it's a cave. The leprechaun lair is a cave. So it's dark. It's black, except for where the characters are, which is all lit up. So any matte lines are covered up by the blackness of the cave.
Yeah,
It's a clever trick.
It really is just very forward thinking for them in hiding stuff. Because I know that they're not thinking like, wow, one of these days somebody's going to be watching this in ultra high def, you know? It's like,
yeah.
But even doing that, you're like, wow, this really holds up.
It's really weird because, again, it's like comparing this to a later movie like Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and it's night and day.
But also, I think this one kind of had more budget proportionally.
Hmm.
I don't know that for sure, but I think this one probably did.
With the amount of actors that they use in this movie, and the sizes of the sets they use to make the leprechauns little people sized, it would have to have a big budget. At least for 40s, 50s era Disney.
Yeah.
So obviously, Darby does not want to stay in the leprechaun lair for the rest of his life. So he tries something and it somehow works. He tries to say, well, I would love to have fun with you, but I need to go home and retrieve some things. And if I had my fiddle, I could play you a song and we could we can really get this party started. And the leprechaun says, well, we have a fiddle that we got from the king of the fairies. So, yes, there's the leprechaun.
The king of the Italian fairies.
So, yes, so
because it's a Stradivarius.
So he gets the violin, a proper Stradivarius violin from the king of the Italian fairies. That, well, it's not a Irish fiddle, but it'll do. So he plays he starts playing a sad song. He pipes it up into a peppy, happy song. And I believe it's called The Fox Chase is what they call the song. And the leprechauns kind of get too into the song because they start riding their fairy-sized horses and have a big chase throughout the fairy lair before exiting the fairy lair to hunt a fox. leprechauns are going to hunt a fox. I'm just going to put that out there. In the middle of the night, they were so inspired by this song that in the middle of the night, the entire fairy clan, the entire leprechaun clan on leprechaun-sized horses are going to go out to hunt a full-sized fox. That is one hell of a song you played, Mr. O'Gill.
They got magic.
True, but still. As long as it's night anyway, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But Darby uses this opening to escape. He goes home because he wants to see his daughter, you know, and he wants to make sure his daughter's not worrying about him and anything. And I do like how kind of cold the Leprechaun King is when he talks about his daughter. Like, she'll mourn you and she'll forget about you in a few days. Now, I don't know if that's how little he sees the daughter, or is this some sort of fairy magic that she's going to forget?
Could be either.
Could be either. He escapes when the fairies go off to hunt their fox. But the fairies catch up. The fairy king catches up to him and says, hey, what are you doing here? We had a deal. You weren't supposed to leave. He tries to cover up, saying, "Hey, I actually came back to just get my pipe. I don't need anything else. Let me say goodbye to my daughter. Let me get my pipe, and we can go back to the fairy lair, and I'll live there forever. But first, let's have a drink to celebrate this occasion." And for lack of a better term, it's Irish moonshine.
Yeah, it's poutine.
Yeah.
It's where we get Mountain Dew from. At least the term.
The term Mountain Dew. Though if Mountain Dew was freaking moonshine, it'd be different doing the dew. So basically the plan is to get that they're going to drink this Irish moonshine, get drunk off their butts, fall asleep, and then it's morning now, and like I said, the leprechauns have all of their powers at night, but once the sun comes out, the leprechauns have no power. Like, the leprechaun king, he tries to escape through the door by phasing through the door. He can't do that because he doesn't have his powers. Darby starts to send his cat after the king to eat him. Darby wants a do-over on the wishes. He says that he will let the leprechaun king go if he grants him a do-over on the three wishes. Which the king kind of doesn't have a choice here. Because if he says no, he's cat food. And to a cat, that leprechaun king probably looks like a mouse. So he says his first wish is that you will stay with me for 2 weeks, a fortnight, until I can think of what my other two wishes are going to be. And that's his first wish. But he's carrying this potato sack around that has the leprechaun king inside of it.
The only effect that doesn't hold up is when he picks up the leprechaun king and it turns into a little puppet.
Yeah, whatever doll they're using to represent. I mean, at least they don't show the face, which, you know.
Yeah.
So,
But he's got that little puppet that, you know, it's got like little buttons or whatever on the other side.
Yeah.
To flail the arms and legs. But it goes from really good effects of you seeing like the giant hand coming down to grab the leprechaun king, and then you just see Darby O'Gill holding a puppet, flailing its little puppet arms and legs. It's very funny.
Yeah.
And then there are occasional times where you see the puppet inside the bag, and you can see that something is working the puppet to make the bag wiggle back and forth. And that does make me laugh. 'Cause you can see the outline of the puppet inside the little burlap sack he's got.
And as all of this is happening, we start a little flirtation between Katie and Michael. And again, it's a Disney movie, so we get a song, Pretty Irish Girl. So in one of his first movies, Sean Connery is singing about falling in love with a pretty Irish girl. The song isn't that bad.
No, that and the wishing song, which we'll get to in a little bit. I mean, both of the little songs they have are kind of cute.
But they start this flirtation between the two of them, but both of them don't exactly want to commit to the flirtation. Like they have the little flirtation. Like I said, Katie is very adamant about not wanting to get married. And seemingly Michael also does not want to get married, or at least does not want women that throw themselves upon him. It's very weird. Not that Michael doesn't want women that throw themselves upon him and he wants to be with them or anything, but it's like the two are very anti-relationship. And I felt that I understand that this is a old school Disney movie and times were different then, but could you imagine how different this movie would be if they were both very stead in their beliefs of not getting married and not having relationships?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's me. You
It's
think?
not.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you on that.
Eventually, Darby, the next, since it is the next day, Darby does get the horse and the cart and goes to the neighboring town and gets the bell. Yay. He even tries to show Michael the King of the Leprechauns to prove that it's true, that not only the leprechauns are real, but I've captured the King of the Leprechauns. He is in this potato sack. And all Michael can see is a rabbit, which goes back to the theory that the Darby himself might be the poacher of the land, since he's, according to Michael's point of view, capturing the rabbits that live on the land and putting them in potato sacks.
Yeah, could be.
I mean, if someone said that they had the King of the Leprechauns in a sack and shows you the sack and you see a rabbit.
And they're coming to it as if it were royalty.
Yes. So the whole situation ends up another trick. Because now Darby says, I wish you could see him. Wish granted. Now Darby has wasted two wishes. And I love, again, the fae are always tricksters. He says, well, he can see me. He'll see me as a rabbit. And like he's having this argument with the king, and the king is kind of arguing back to him. And Darby is just looking at Michael, says, can't you hear him? I can't hear anything. I'm just hearing you talk to this rabbit.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at this old man talking to a sack to and having an argument with a rabbit, you might think that maybe Mr. O'Gill should have been retired a few years earlier. The Leprechaun King makes a deal with him that he'll give him a freebie. He will see me in his dreams. So as long as Michael is asleep, he'll be able to see the Leprechaun King. I almost said Goblin King. Same difference, but I'm gonna go with it.
Well, they're both fae creatures.
Yeah. So basically, as long as Michael is asleep, he can see the Leprechaun King and hear him and all of that. So it's a bit of a compromise, a freebie. We mentioned it, but yeah, now Pony is a bit more aggressive in trying to get Katie's affections.
Nice way of putting that.
I'm trying to be nice about it, but yeah, he's very stalkery. He's very, you will be with me or there will be problems. To which Michael's like, you know what? You are not welcome here. Please leave Katie alone. Yeah. So like other men are starting to flirt with Katie. Pony is very aggressive towards them. He breaks one guy's wrist for even talking to Katie. So it's like, no, no, Katie's mine. You will not look at her. You will not talk to her. No one will say anything to her except me. She is mine. I have staked my claim because women have no anonymity, no agency. They are property. Blah. This bothers Darby. He doesn't like the idea of Pony getting close to Katie, his daughter. He doesn't like this idea, and seemingly neither does the Leprechaun King. So basically, he tries to play matchmaker by, you know, if there is someone who is going to take care of Katie after he's gone, he actually would prefer it to be Michael and not Pony or any of the other men in the town. So he strikes a deal with the Leprechaun King. Hey, I need you to play matchmaker. Go to Michael, try to convince him to propose to Katie. Go to Katie, try to convince him to accept Michael's proposal. And in their respective dreams, both of them say no. Like Michael originally says, I don't know her. I've only known Katie a day. I can't ask her to marry me. I can't do any of that. I want to know them first. I want to form a real relationship, a real thing before I make my move. Which, good on Michael. Good on Michael that he at least wants to form some sort of relationship before diving into marriage. Although he's still not exactly 100% on the I'm getting married bandwagon. And then the Leprechaun King goes to Katie in her dreams, tries to talk to her, hey, you shouldn't go be with Pony, you should be with Michael, Michael's a good guy, you should marry him. And then Katie says, no, bye, I don't want to get married, I don't want to get married to anybody. The answer is no. I mean, that's the Leprechaun King even says, I will let you have the final word. And Katie in her dreams say, my final word is no. She does not want a husband. She does not want to get married to anyone. Which, good on her. She knows her worth. And if she feels that she does not want to be anyone's wife, that is her choice. Again, but this is a Disney movie, so we'll get to it. So I mentioned the letter earlier. The letter is eventually delivered to the caretaker's house where Katie looks at it. Now she hates Michael because, hey, when were you going to tell me that you took my dad's job? When was my father going to tell me that he lost his job? You're going to kick us out. She's packing her stuff. You know, were you trying to flirt with me to make it easier that you were going to kick me out of my house? So it's like, bullies this is where they really become like the evil people at this point. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But like she also doesn't want the house cleaning job because again, she believes Michael took her father's job. And she does not want to work with someone who stole her father's job. She says, you know, you can clean this house yourself. I don't want to be, you know, Michael even says, you know, does this mean you don't love me? Which, again, we just had this conversation in your dreams, dude, that you did not want to rush into anything if you wanted to get to anything at all. And Katie, She's already angry because in her mind, you've taken her father's job. You're kicking them out of the house she's lived in her entire life. And then you dare to ask this woman if she loves you? After, and his own words, they've only known each other a day. It feels like there should have been more time here, but given the progression of this movie, it's very weird. Like, less than 12 hours ago, you were in your bed saying you did not want to rush into anything. Here you are saying, does this mean you don't love me? But he does say he wants her to stay there. He wants her and her father to stay on the land. They're going to have their own house on the land. It just won't be this one. He straight up says, I want you to stay here and be my wife. Again, after only knowing each other a day, which he said didn't want to do. Is this his true feelings? Is this fey magic? I don't know.
So the thing is that, like, okay, Katie really hates Michael because, like, you took my dad's job and you took our house and everything. But let's call it what it is here. Darby, in trying to, like, protect his daughter or whatever nonsense until he can get gold from the leprechauns or whatever, he doesn't tell her what the offer was. If he'd have told her what the offer was, I think she'd have been like, oh yeah, that's way more than fair. You realize that we're still living in, like, feudalism or whatever nonsense, right? Because, like, she doesn't know that her father is still gonna get paid half salary. I don't think they mentioned that in the whole, like, thing. Maybe they did. I don't really remember. I've only seen it the once. But, and then it's like, oh yeah, we're gonna be moving to a different house. But she probably thinks, like most people would, like, well, now my dad has no job and now we've got to pay rent on this other house. You know? Like, if I was being kicked out of my house that came with a job, and then they were like, oh, well, you can stay over there, but now you don't have a job and stuff, my first thought would be like, well, how am I going to pay rent on that place? Not, it comes free for the rest of my dad's life. Because that's not typically how things work.
Which is why I would say this lord is very generous for the dip. Yeah, very generous.
Yeah, and if somebody had just sat Katie down, Darby, and been like, hey, look, I know it's very sad that we've got to leave the house you grew up in. You become very attached to it. You know? But we get free house over there, half wages, you get a job every now and then if you want to supplement your income while you're looking for a husband or another job or whatever you want to do with the rest of your life. You know? I think she'd have been, like, more chill about the whole thing.
Yeah, this is our The part of the romantic comedy where the truth comes out. If they had just been honest with each other, we could have avoided half this movie. But you're right. Darby thought he was protecting Katie, and in doing so, ends up risking her life.
Yeah, because somehow the horse gets loose, and Michael's like, oh, it's too dangerous, you gotta stay here. She's like, I don't trust you, you're a liar. There is something, okay, here's the thing that I didn't understand, and maybe you can clear it up for me. There's something about a letter, and people keep reading a letter, and they're like, oh, look at this letter, it's gonna change everything, and then they never tell what's in the letter.
I think it's the same letter that the Lord written to them the first time of, hey, I'm going to be coming back to the residence in a few days, and here's everything to explain everything. And I think that's what they're talking about, but maybe Katie never read the whole letter. She just kind of stopped when it said, hey, yeah, Michael's taking over your job and you have to move out by this time. By the time I get back, make sure your things are gone.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
That was the one thing that I couldn't quite understand, is because all the townsfolk were like, oh no, there's a letter and it contains horrible secrets or something. And I was like, what's the horrible secret? And then they just never told.
I think it's just the letter that the Lord sent explaining the situation to tell Darby, hey, make sure you have all of your stuff moved out of the caretaker's house by the time I get back. Bum.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a dark and stormy night, and the Puka horse decides to go for a runabout, and Katie goes to chase after it, and Michael's like, hey, maybe don't do that because it's a dark and stormy night and you'll get dead. And she's like, eh, screw you, you're a liar and I'm not listening to you. And they have a bit of a tiff, and then the bully shows up and whacks Sean Connery around the head and is like, hey, I'm gonna move your body over to the manor house and douse you with a bunch of liquor so that when the Lord shows up, he'll be like, oh, look, you're passed out covered in liquor on my stoop, and that means you're a drunk.
You're fired. I'm gonna hire Pony to take your place, which is their plan from the get-go.
Yeah, and I love how Darby shows up, even worried about his daughter, looks at Sean Connery, sniffs Sean Connery, smells all the liquor, and he's like, hey, are you drunk? And Sean Connery's like, nope, got a concussion. And he's like, yeah, seems right. And that's the end of that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, Darby O'Gill is the only person in this entire town with, like, brains. I mean, Sean Connery's got, like, half brains.
I mean, he does have a wicked scar on the side of a wicked mark.
Yeah, he's got, like, a bruise or something where the dude hit him, so you can kind of believe it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just drinking a bunch generally doesn't leave, like, a giant bruise on the side of your face.
Unless you fall.
Well, yeah, but the way he's kind of just slumped over there, that's not really, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Darby O'Gill's like, yeah, you know, that makes more sense than a guy we've never seen do more than have, like, a pint in the pub is suddenly drunk and passed out. So, Michael's like, Katie's going up to find the horse, and, Darby's like, oh yeah, no, that's not a horse, that's a Puka, because Puka kept taking over my horse, and instead of, like, you know, I don't know, selling the horse and getting one that's not, you know, inhabited by a Puka, I just
do
kept
you
it.
Want to upset the Fae by selling it?
I mean, you know, maybe get the priest to bless it or something.
We're going to have a horse exorcism. I don't think they thought about that in this movie.
I mean, you know, I'd do something like that.
Yeah, the
priest
is going to
be like, Pazuzu, get up out of my horse, you know? Like,
the priest just disappears after that first scene in the movie.
Yeah, the priest is like, go get me a bell, and now I'm just gonna, like, wander off and not be of any use for the rest of the movie. But yeah, anyway, they're like, standing around being like, where's Katie? And then they hear a banshee, and they're like, oh, she about to die.
So they're able to get Katie away from the banshee, but it's too late.
No, you can't skip over the banshee. No, no, no.
Okay, go ahead then.
And so that they go, they hear a scream, and Darby's like, "No, it's a banshee. I heard a banshee the night her mother died. We gotta go save her." And they run up the mountain, and this is where the movie just straight up turns into a horror flick, and I am here for it. Because this is pretty awesome. I don't know how you felt about it, but I was like, okay, now we're like, this is what Ichabod should have looked like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how this hit you, but I liked it.
The color effect they put on the Banshee is a bit dated.
Well, yeah, but it was the 40s. Come on, dude.
Yeah.
But I liked the way they did it, and I liked that he's like, "No, stay away from my daughter." And the Banshee's like, "No." And then he's like, "Screw you. I'm going to throw a lantern at you." And the Banshee's like, "All right, then.
You can see through me. The lantern ain't going to do anything."
Yeah, but, you know, Banshee's like, "All right, you can, like, throw fire at me or whatever. Just go away. Thought we were having fun, but throwing things now.
It's going to die anyway."
Yeah. And the thing is that you think that, like, Katie has fallen off a cliff and, like, hit her head or whatever, and Darby's all like, "Oh no, my poor sweet daughter, I've done killed her or whatever." And Michael's like, "Hey, let's get her home. I'm gonna pick her up in my big, strong Sean Connery arms," you know. And they take her back home, and then they're like, "She's got a fever." And I'm like, "The hell? Since when does falling off a cliff give you a fever?"
It is dark, stormy night, so it's probably sickness from being out in the rain.
Well, yeah, but come on, dude. You don't get a fever from, like, being out in the rain for a minute and a half.
Let's be real. They needed to find a way to give this movie a happy ending. So if she fell out and had a concussion and she was dying, what happens at the end of this movie isn't going to bring her back to life.
Well, yeah, but if she'd have, like, fallen and smacked her head, they could have been like, "We can't get her to wake up." And then at the end of the movie, they could have been like, "Oh, it's a miracle. She woke up." You know?
Mm-hmm.
That would have been fine. You know, it's like, "Oh, no, she smacked her head and fell into a coma. Oh, she woke up. She's going to be okay." I mean, she still rang her bell pretty badly, but, you know, maybe she's not so bad, you know?
But kudos to Darby, because he fights the Banshee.
Yeah, the Banshee's like, "Okay, let's try this again without you, like, throwing
fire at me."
Fire at me. And Darby's like, "Screw you, now I'm going to throw farm implements at you." And that's even funnier.
Like, it's
just
going through her. It's nothing. I assume it's a woman because I always associate Banshee with female, but that's me.
Yeah.
But it's going right through this Banshee. He's swinging. It's going right through the Banshee. Nothing's doing. He just throws it. It goes right through her. And it's like, the Banshee just looks at her. And whatever makeup job they had on the person playing the Banshee is enhanced by the color grading they put on her, or whoever it is. Because that does look freaky. I will give him that much. When you see the face of the Banshee, it looks freaky.
Honestly, I kind of liked it better in the mountains when they didn't show the face.
Mm.
I thought it lost a little something when they showed the face.
Mm.
But I didn't think, I mean, like, I wasn't like, "Oh, now it sucks," you know, but you know, it's all right both ways. I just thought it was slightly scarier when you couldn't see the face.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite part is he's like fighting. I can't tell if it was like a shovel or a scythe or what, but, you know, he's got some farm implement and he's like swinging for the fences against his Banshee, And then he just like throws it, and he just throws it through the banshee and up onto the roof of the cottage, which I totally love. I'm like, you know, after the end of the movie, he's like, great. Hey, Sean Connery, get up on the roof and get me my random farm implement that I used to fight off a banshee.
But then the banshee just points. And you see the death coach.
I like the death coach. I think the death coach is my favorite part of it.
Like, they are coming for Katie. They are going to take her to the afterlife. And Darby is crapping his pants. No, no, not my little girl. Please, no. Your Highness, please send it away with your powers. I'll make that my third wish. And he says, I can't do that. Once the death coach has been summoned, there's nothing we can do. A soul has to go into the death coach. That's how it works. So in a moment of protecting, his daughter says, then put me in her place. Let the death coach come for me and not my daughter. And I do like how the Leprechaun King kind of looks at him. It's like, are you sure you want to do this? Because once you go, there's no coming back. You will never see her again. You'll be dead. But if it's the only way to save his daughter's life, he's going to do it. And that he can do. He does grant the third wish of allowing Darby to take his daughter's place on the death coach and die. I wish that they had given the writer a different voice, because it's the similar Disney dark voice of that era.
Get in the coach.
Yeah, I wish they hadn't tried to make that voice a
room
little bit more.
Room for one more.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing that it's the same voice you would hear in the freaking Haunted Mansion. So it's like, which is fine because it's a Disney park ride and you're not supposed to be scared crapless anyway, but this is supposed to be this big scary scene and you just hear this, you know, climb in your dune buggy. I will lower the bar for you.
Yeah. But it's still kind of, it didn't take me out of it quite so bad. Because it's like, all right, you know, I'm still focusing on the sadness of the moment and the niceness of the sacrifice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't pull me out that bad.
So Darby gets in the coach. He takes one last look at his house as the death coach goes away. And the King of the Leprechaun appears one more time to say his goodbyes to Darby. You know, you've been a worthy adversary. I'm going to miss you. I wish I could accompany you all the way. And then Darby says, yeah. I wish I wasn't doing this alone either. And then the Leprechaun King says, oh man, I thought you were smart. You fell for it again. You've made a fourth wish and you know the rules. If you make that fourth wish, you lose everything. Now get out of here, Darby. And just kicks him out of the death coach. Which, I love that the Leprechaun King used that to get him out of the, so Darby didn't have to die. But
it's kind of sweet.
But I'm thinking, if the wishes are null and void, doesn't that mean that Katie still has to die because let me take her place was the wish and that wish is now null and void?
I mean, that was what I kind of first thought too.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I guess not, because Disney movie.
Yeah, because once Darby gets back to the house, they say, oh, her fever broke. She woke up. She's going to be fine. It reminded me of the Twilight Zone episode, one for the Angels, in which Edwin plays a salesman, and he sees that this little girl is going to die. So he sees Death going to go to her, and he distracts Death just enough that the time lapses away, so Death cannot take this little girl anymore. That's what it kind of reminded me of. If you've never seen that episode of The Twilight Zone, I do recommend it. It is one of Edwin's best performances. But yeah, Darby comes back. He sees his daughter is fine. She's going to make a full recovery. And it looks like Michael and Katie are actually going to commit to this, to their relationship.
And they sing the song again.
But there's still one loose thread here, and that is Pony. Now, Michael says, well, I don't know if I got hit last night. I got jumped last night, and somebody poured alcohol on me. Now, I don't know if it was you, but I'm pretty sure it was you, and then punches him in the face.
But he also said that the King of the Leprechauns visited him and told him to go punch Pony.
Now, was this Michael making a tall tale to stand up for his potential future father-in-law, or did the Leprechaun King actually come to him and explain the situation?
I think it's more fun if we never know. The end.
Yeah, and yay, they sing the Irish girl song, and yay, happy ending. Honestly, I will say one more thing before we really get into it, is that Disney has had this habit of their older movies looking as pristine as possible. And this one does not look as pristine as other movies that of this era that they've kept around. And I had to do a double check on this one to some clips of the movie on YouTube. And it looks like that for at least for the Disney Plus version, they've cropped it to widescreen, which does alter the quality of the movie. Because on the YouTube clips, it looks fine. On the Disney Plus version, it looks like a zoomed in full screen shot that you would see on like early YouTube, like really not so good quality. I don't know whose decision that was, but usually Disney does not have that, even for their older movies of the 40s and 50s, does not have that doesn't usually look this bad, but maybe it's me.
I mean, I'll agree with you. I know it has had at least one restoration over the years, but it's not quite as sharp as some of the ones that they do.
Yeah, so, I mean, this looks like it looks like somebody VHS the copy off the Blu-ray. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody, but it looks like somebody like did a VHS recording of this on a television airing, which doesn't look good for Disney, especially for these older movies. But this movie wasn't bad. Like you said, a lot of the practical effects still hold up. It still falls into a lot of the tropes of the Disney movies of this era. Like I said, I think that they really wanted this movie to have a happy ending. And I think that that last 20 minutes kind of suffers for it. Now, I'm not saying that Katie needed to die. But it feels like they had to rewrite something to make it make sense that Katie comes out of her funk. Oh, she had a fever. Like you said, she had a fever. How did she get a fever? She could have easily said, oh, she's unconscious. She won't wake up. We don't know what we're going to do. I don't know. But for the most part, the movie holds up pretty well. It's a nice, cute movie. Much like the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes last week, my knowledge of the movie prior to watching it for this podcast was seeing it advertised in the clamshell VHSs I had back in the day. So this was not what I thought this movie was, but that doesn't make it bad.
You know what's really weird to me is that one of the reasons why we kind of wanted to do this movie is because we thought, and because we had heard, that it was like a really bad, goofy film that Disney had done that had early Sean Connery in it.
Yeah, and when he passed away a few years back, we said, okay, we'll put it on the list. And then we had heard that this movie had a lot of controversy in it, that it's a movie that Disney kind of wants to forget exists. And it's like, watching the movie is like, where's the controversy? What is in this movie that Disney doesn't want to admit it exists?
And also, what about this movie is really all that bad? Like, I was expecting like a Mystery Science Theater movie.
I was expecting, you know, the this movie and it has offensive stereotypes intro that we would get in certain movies of this era.
Yeah, I mean, I was expecting everybody to be running around, you know, screaming top of the morning to you or whatever, like every third sentence,
and everyone having the Irish jig and Lucky Charms and all that stuff.
Yeah, and none of that happened. I mean, this was like for the 1940s, this was a shockingly respectful
this movie is tame. Like, what was the big controversy with this? If someone knows more about this movie than I, was it a production thing? Did people not like the movie? I mean, if it wasn't a hit, that doesn't make it controversial. If it was just, oh, it's Sean Connery's early work that he doesn't want to acknowledge, that doesn't make it controversial. Not everyone loves every movie that they're in. I mean, every actor has that one movie that they want to just delete off their wiki page, but they can't.
Yeah. And the thing is that this movie was incredibly watchable. And not only that, but, you know, decently entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, this is tame. This is fine. This is a fine family film that I did not find anything wrong with it. I think that's the only thing, is that I went into this movie expecting it to be mind-numbingly offensive and this is just the way it was back in the day, but this movie's fine. There's nothing offensive in here, at least to me. Again, if you're Irish and you watched this movie and found some offense, let us know, but I did not find any offense in here. I did not find it. It's tame. It's fine. It's just a fine little family film that, you know, 90 minutes just flew by. It was an easy watch. I will say that compared to the movies we've been watching over the last couple of weeks, this was probably one of the most easy watches I've personally had.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine to me, you know?
Yeah. So, does this movie have the magic? I Yeah.
I mean, again, not the greatest movie in the Disney catalog, but I was expecting something rather atrocious given a lot of the stuff I'd heard about this. It's a fine movie. It's a decent little movie. You
Yeah.
want something to watch around St. Patrick's Day that's kind of, you know, fun, kid-friendly, whatever.
It's harmless.
Yeah.
I mean, that's me. I find this movie harmless, and that's fine. But yeah, this is when we have magic. Yeah, sure.
Sure.
You know, it's not going to go on my must watch list for St. Patrick's Day movies, but it's harmless. Fine. So yeah, next week. Oh, I think I just jinxed myself. Next week is Mars Needs Moms.
You know what? I'm willing to give it a chance because we just learned after this week, maybe we've been hearing wrong things.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But, you know, it's the movie that caused them to change John Carter. Because the movie didn't do any very well. And they came away thinking it's because it had the word Mars in the title and we cannot have a movie with the word Mars in it.
Well, we'll see if that's the reason.
So come back next week for Mars Needs Moms. Kind of feeling we should have waited that one for Mother's Day, but we're going to do it anyway next week. But so come back next week for Mars Needs Moms, and we will talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye.
Don't let the magic stop here. Join our conversations on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Rewatching the Magic. We are on the X, formerly known as Twitter, at Rewatch the Magic. And new episodes are available every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.
Podcasts are fun.
But there's work to be done.
We encourage you to get involved. Here are some organizations we support.
The American Civil Liberties Union fights for the constitutional rights of all Americans. Find them at ACLU.org.
The National Network of Abortion Funds helps people find access to safe abortion services. Their site is abortionfunds.org.
The Trevor Project provides a 24/7 crisis helpline for LGBTQ youth and education services for schools on LGBTQ issues. They can be found at thetrevorproject.org.
Or find a way to help in your area.